This is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, in for Terry Gross. Science fiction is a literature of ideas, but one necessarily tied to science. Many of the great SF novels of the 1950s still work as stories, but they're almost laughably out of date in technology. Werner Vinge is both a victim and a perpetrator of this conundrum. 20 years ago, he wrote a science fiction novella called True Names that projected computers powerful enough to generate what we now call cyberspace. The net also figures prominently in his brilliant award-winning novel, A Fire on the Deep. Werner Vinge, however, is also a professor emeritus of mathematics and computer science at San Diego State University, who believes that everything he and everyone else has written will probably be out of date in the post-human era, an event he suspects will begin in about 25 years.
When you look at the advances in computers, there's one common rule of thumb that's applied to them called Moore's Law, which has various more or less precise definitions, but roughly speaking, it's that things get, for the same price, things get better with computers at about double every year and a half or 2 years. Other people have taken this and tried to estimate how powerful is our thinking process as human beings. And in fact, we are enormously more powerful, in case people haven't guessed, we're enormously more powerful than any computer that was ever built. It's so laughably more powerful that, in fact, this is probably why any discussion of superhuman computers sounds so frivolous.
This is despite all the chess programs and that sort of thing.
Right. If you try to make an estimate of how computationally powerful we are as humans, it is very powerful. On the other hand, Moore's Law is doubling every year and a half or 2 years. So there have been a fair number of people who've tried to make some estimate of how swift and intelligent we are in terms of what our basic hardware is like, and come to the conclusion that if Moore's Law were to continue for another 20 years or so, that we would hit a crossover point, that we would hit a point where it would be possible to make computers as powerful as a human, assuming someone could figure out, you know, how to program them. And in fact, that's not, to me, that's amazing and wonderful and so on. It's not especially shattering because we already know how to make things as smart as people. We can do it. It takes about 9 months. But the important thing about the crossover point is what happens a year or two after that. If you got critters that were smarter than humans in significant ways, more creative, then in a way, the thing that really differentiates us from the rest of the animal kingdom, we have lost being at the top of. And the thing that makes it possible for us to predict what's going to happen technologically is our creative intelligence. Well, if the central players are actually of a greater intelligence than that, then that means after that sort of a crossover point, people who try to do prognostications, like science fiction writers,
right,
like in any sort of even a product manager types, for in a fundamental way, they are out of the loop. One analogy I use is in the past, if you were a futurologist, you could make predictions. Like if we could have in some magic way bring Mark Twain into this studio this afternoon, take him outside, in a weekend he would be up to speed about our world. And I think he'd love it because he was sort of a techno freak. If you were to bring a goldfish into this studio, there's no way you could explain to it what we're doing, much less what the rest of the world is about. And to me, that would be the distinction between prognostication about technology as it has existed in the past and our trying to make prognostication about technology after this crossover point.
In a correlation, though, between your two worlds of mathematics, computer science on the one hand and science fiction on the other, Asimov's famous three laws of robotics, and that is, of course, restrictions on the robots to make sure that they don't take over.
Right. Basically, it's a hierarchy of laws ultimately trying to ensure that although these robots would do what we want, that they won't hurt us. And these are to be built into the mechanism of these human and superhuman machines. So we're talking about stuff that nobody has ever done and it being done in ways that we can't understand. So this is fun, but I don't claim it's in any way definitive or true, but My personal belief is that if you tried to make laws like that, ones that didn't have enough wiggle room so that a really smart robot could think around them, mm-hmm. you might be able to do it, but it would be a very uncompetitive product. In other words, very likely the way this stuff would happen would be out of competition, military competition, economic competition, even artistic competition. And in such a situation, if you built a critter that was strictly enough regulated so it really couldn't think its way around these laws, I don't think it would be competitive against other people who would make things that were a little bit more loosely constrained.
It would also assume that if you're building in these self-protective laws, that you're intending actually to build something that is smarter than human.
Yes, and I think it's very likely that when this really happens, it will not necessarily be because of someone's proximate conscious effort to make it happen. The whole issue of human-computer interfacing, you know, keyboards, mm-hmm. mouses, all of this stuff is really a long, long path dedicated to the same thing, making it easier for us to use these devices to get answers that we want. And so as we move into more and more easy interactions with machines, wearable computers, implantable computers, very large systems, say, that are automatically controlling highway systems and things like this. It's a slide that I don't think has any one particular moment where you can say, oh, we don't want to do that. That might be dangerous.
So it's likely to happen almost by accident.
Yes. Now, I think there are arguments for saying that it wouldn't happen. In fact, one thing has been fun for me over the years is to collect all the reasons why people say this is all impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are just sort of gut-level things about, you know, machines and people. I think that if it doesn't happen, the most likely reason, the most likely apparent reason will be that we never figure out how to write these really big computer programs that would be necessary to do all this wonderful stuff.
Incompetence would be in our way.
Our incompetence with software complexity or the complexity of large systems. Moore's law is one thing, but if you talk to a programmer about Moore's law and about some of the things we're talking about, most of them will roll their eyes and they'll say, "Have you ever worked on any really large program?" I suspect that in order for this stuff to work out the way I'm talking about, mm-hmm. we would have to have some fundamentally different ways of looking at creating large systems. It wouldn't be programming. It'd be more biological. And in fact, the problem has been solved. I believe the human brain has about 100 billion neurons, and each of those neurons is arguably as powerful as a computer CPU.
Mm-hmm.
And they all do work together. So there actually are working models that have solved these massive parallelism problems. That's the strongest reason to believe there's some way of doing it. I don't think it will be done by anything like what we think of as software engineering or programming.
Well, such speculation inevitably leads you into philosophical, even religious questions.
Yes. In fact, I think the analogy with the standard religious, you know, the coming of the New Age religious stuff, or as I think science fiction writer Ken MacLeod put it, the techno-rapture,
mm-hmm.
referring it to as techno-rapture.
That's a great word.
It really has psychologically, the hierarchy of ideas, if you just look at what is being said about conclusions, it looks isomorphic. It looks the same shape as many of the religious transcendental event type things in the past. I think that's a valid descriptive criticism. I think there is still kind of the necessity of sitting down and looking at this case and looking at what is actually going on and deciding whether the similarity of shape is an accident or it's a mental failure of the people running around talking about the techno rapture.
But we feel intrinsically that there is something beyond simple computing power that makes us, that translates to that quality of being human, that simple accumulation of computing power in a machine will never make it human.
I think that's actually the strongest internal gut criticism of the notion. For me, I think that criticism is not... is not really valid. We have not seen really powerful machines. And furthermore, I would certainly grant that the organization of the machine and the way the different parts work with each other, talk to each other, mm-hmm. is supremely important. If we don't do this, I think it will be because we just don't figure out how to get very large numbers of these devices to coordinate the way our brain cells coordinate with one another. But you've put your finger on kind of the internal reason why, the sort of hardwired reason within us that this whole thing looks very implausible.
Yet, if you get a machine that I guess has enough computational power to it, it'll acquire. Well, they used to say about the difference between the U.S. Air Force and the Soviet Air Force. And the U.S. Air Force had much better quality planes, but the Soviets had much more of them. And they used to argue that a quantity has a quality all its own.
There are some people who think that if we just made a computer that say had as many processors as the human brain, and did fairly routine things with it, that it would eventually quote wake up, unquote. I don't know whether that's true or not. I really sort of doubt it. I suspect that it's very likely we're going to get to the point where we make machines this large, because you look at Moore's law and you look at market forces. The demand is there for other reasons for machines to get this powerful. There are a couple things that could go wrong. We may have underestimated how powerful single neurons are. There are some people who think that single neurons are as good as the largest computer that was ever been built.
Well, that seems to just postpone the date, not
yeah, that would just
it.
Postpone it. So the more likely failure scenario would be, we make something this big and don't figure out how to make the parts talk. Probably the way, if we do succeed in doing it, it will be a matter of growing certain sorts of behaviors into it and teaching the thing, much as what happens, say, in the first 9 months of a fetus's life and then the first year or two after that, where there's an awful lot of sort of formation that occurs. There are very serious people around who believe that that's not the way it is, that it can be done very directly just with a few relatively simple rules that we haven't figured out. They are more optimistic in this direction than I am.
My guest is Werner Vinge. His most recent novel is A Deepness in the Sky. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Werner Vinge's most recent book is A Deepness in the Sky. He's our guest on Fresh Air. In that book, A Deepness in the Sky, you managed to set a book in the far future involving space-faring species that come across a first astronomical phenomenon and set the story to a large degree seemingly in the 1930s.
Yes. I did what has been done in science fiction a lot. I had this alien race. The alien race is about at the level of technology that we were in the 30s. And for me, another fun thing about it was that I turned the Men in Black, the movie and the whole thing about UFOs, mm-hmm. I turned it upside down, because in this story, the humans are the UFOs. We're lurking around at the edges of this a non-human civilization, waiting to take over. And we're watching these guys and watching what they're doing, and they're essentially going through a lot of the stresses that we went through in the 20th century, except in a somewhat intensified form because of their peculiar problems. So this made it easy for me to do a lot of things and play on a lot of issues that are meaningful to us, and still do it realistically in the sense that it is thousands of years from now.
One of the most attractive elements, of course, to people in my business is that one of the most interesting elements of this world is a children's radio program.
Yes. The children's radio program, of course, this is the non-human race. Mm-hmm. The children of that race had this radio program. And the aliens, I mean the humans, remember the humans are the flying saucer people.
Are the ETs,
Yeah, the humans are the ETs. Anyway, the humans are lurking up in space, and they're listening to this radio program. Because radio programs in particular are good for them because they can study the language of the non-humans, just like the reverse in flying saucer stories. Mm-hmm. And they especially like children's radio programs because there the language is simpler. depending on, you know, the age range.
Mm-hmm.
So they had stolen a bunch of children's textbooks earlier in the story to kind of get a start. And then they listened to this children's radio program. And because of various plot stresses in the story, the humans are in a very stressful situation, and they're going to be there for a number of years, and they don't have any children, and they can't see these non-human critters who don't look very nice at all. They're not human-like.
Spiders is what they
are. They look like large spiders. They're not, you know, really spiders, but they have that physical appearance. And so the humans are getting really wrapped up in the radio show. They have all the reasons that I just said for why they're interested in the radio show, but they also have character-driven reasons why they're interested in it. And one of the most fun but trickiest scenes of the book is I have the radio show going on, the children's radio show. The humans are listening. The humans are doing live translations for their own people, you know, like the UN, and that's being just sort of shunted through all the human space station. And there's this interaction as they're trying to figure out what's going on the ground. Then I also have the scenes on the ground sort of intermixed with how the radio show is being seen topside amongst the humans. And so there's a rather tricky interaction of motivations there that ultimately do have some connection, it turns out, rather deep and action-moving connections.
You also, your wife wrote science fiction as well.
Ah, my ex-wife.
Ah.
So we were married from 71 until 79.
This is Joan Vinge.
Right, Joan D. Vinge. And we still actually vet each other's work and you know, talk about the work that each other is doing. So I'm very pleased that she continued with the name Vinge, both for personal and professional reasons.
Did you guys meet in the world of science fiction, or how did that happen?
I was an invited speaker as a science fiction writer at an English course about science fiction. It was an extension course, and she was attending it. This was like 1969, and so that's where we met. So she had been doing some. She'd already been into writing science fiction at that time. She had not sold any, It really was fun, you know. Anytime two pros get to talk about the work they're working on, that is fun. And in this case, since there was also the romance angle, that was also very fun.
But a lot of science fiction writers have a lot of trouble with this little world of conventions and these awards. You know, they almost cringe at the idea of hanging out with people with Spock ears.
Oh, I think actually the science fiction convention part of society is an extraordinarily interesting thing. It is fairly large. It's large enough so that there are people who are intensely interested in particular stories and series of stories like Star Trek,
mm-hmm.
But then also interested in other things. Overall, I don't think it has been done, but it'd be very interesting for some anthropologist to do a thesis on the science fiction convention, the people who go to science fiction conventions. I am very admiring, actually, of the phenomenon of the science fiction conventions. There are situations where it brings together the most creative people in the world in a variety of fields. For instance, the World Science Fiction Convention. I remember wandering around LA Con in 1984 and just seeing what was going on. There were older people, but there were the sort of young Turks from the movie industry, from the writing industry, from the comic book industry, from the general technology industry, and even from the military. And to be able to sit down in a bar or sit or in the exhibits and be talking to people who were actually among the brightest and most creative, even if not the most recognized, is a very extraordinary thing. On balance, I think the science fiction conventions have been an enormous help to young people who have certain sorts of intense, concentrated interests in certain creative and technical fields.
Werner Vinge, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Neil.
Werner Vinge is a professor emeritus of mathematics and computer science at San Diego State University. His most recent novel is A Deepness in the Sky. This is Fresh Air.